Chapter 16. Out of the Fire. A Singular Hatred. A Fogged Mirror. Amon broke the surface of an ocean and drew in a great breath of night air. His chest heaved as his lungs expanded, and the swirling fireflies of light before his eyes began to recede. He took another breath as the grayness faded from his vision, the diminishing tunnel of light he had been drifting towards falling away from him. His breathing coming at more regular intervals, Amon sought to find his bearings. Where was he? His last memory was of seeing his father's face through the water as he was drawn inexorably into the depths, spectral hands dragging him deeper underwater, lungs crying for air, and the cold of the grave spreading through him. He'd fought the things seeking to drown him until eventually they released him. Had he overcome them? Or had they simply tired of him? Putting aside such thoughts as irrelevant, Amon turned around in the water in search of a shore or landmark. He found neither. He was adrift upon a dark ocean, its waters rising and falling with powerful swells. The great ocean? Was this its true face? No. This was something else. Something imagined only in dreams and now made real. A place where the only limits were those souls placed upon themselves. Overhead, a star-filled vault of night stretched from horizon to horizon, but none of the celestial arrangements were familiar to him. Treading water in his heavy armor and sweeping his arms around to keep afloat, Amon felt the first stirrings of unease. Warplate could survive the hard vacuum of space, so it could easily survive immersion in water, but not when it was cracked and split open. He could feel his weight increasing by the second. The spaces within his greaves were already heavy with water, and he felt every void within his armor gurgling as it filled. Water spilled into his mouth and he spat it out. It was fresh, without salt. Not a conventional ocean, then. Amon blinked away a sudden onslaught of imagery flashing through the forefront of his mind in quick succession. These were no Corvidae visions of potential futures, but living recollections of things he had already experienced. He relived fighting the wolves on Prospero, experienced the joy of seeing the Emperor at Nicaea, before that joy turned to dismay. His chest swelled as he remembered marching at the forefront of the Great Crusade and exploring ever more intricate and beautiful expressions of knowledge. He laughed as he remembered volumes he had not read in a century, music he had listened to as a boy, and art he had wept upon seeing in an alien gallery. "The water is memory." His efforts to stay afloat faltered, and his head went under the surface. The ocean was not, as he had first supposed, water, in the truest sense of the word. Liquid, yes, but so much more than water. Its substance was so fine it was silken, and made up of so many infinitesimal particulates that every molecule within every droplet was a limitless repository of gathered wisdom. Lights swam in the depths, darting things that moved in pairs like mating birds rolling and diving in the air. What were they? He felt the essence of myriad lives and experiences unlived, the infinite complexity of the intersections between souls, and knew he swam in an ocean of ever-expanding knowledge. "I will swim this dream sea," he thought. "I will hear every secret it has to show me." Amon went under the water, and, piece by piece, tore off his armor. Each plate sank into the darkness, and he sensed the ocean's hunger to learn from it. The darting lights were drawn to it, seeking to know what alien suns had warmed it, what impacts had blistered its paint, and what tales it could tell of the being who once wore it. Freed from his armor, Amon reveled in his newfound lightness of being. He picked a direction and set off, his body energized and no longer pained by the terrible hurts it had endured. Amon had no notion of how long he swam, each stroke and spray of water imparting fresh understandings and differing perspectives. He rolled onto his back, staring up at the unmoving stars, and only the expanding horizons within his mind gave Amon any clue as to the passage of time. He allowed himself to sink into the water, digesting the works of the great Jovian architects, the life of a worker in the labour camps surrounding the emperor's great Himalayan works, and shared the thrill of excavating a long-lost city beneath the dust bowl south of Tali. He swam back to the surface, giddy with the sheer joy of learning things thought beyond his understanding. But as he prepared to set off again, he saw something of the world around him had changed. Ahead, the edge of the horizon was broken by the outline of something rising from the water. An island? Amon struck out towards it with powerful strokes. As he drew nearer, a quiescent sense of dread crept up on him. Something of this island appeared somehow fixed, where everything else around him was fluid and inconstant, filled with possibility and the potential for growth. After so liberating a time in the ocean, he did not relish setting foot on land where change was anathema. But what other choice was there? The island swiftly grew in scale, its dimensions impossible to guess, but clearly enormous. Amon saw the mass was not in fact one island, but many thousands, all linked by arched bridges like the steelwork frame beneath the pyramid of Fotep. He saw curious formations in the island's mass, suggestive of forms he felt he ought to recognize. Each resemblance was more profound than the last, but he could not be sure any were intended, for they changed upon his next glance. Perhaps this island was not so fixed, after all. Amon reached its sheer edge and climbed from the water. Its substance was porous and gnarled, like an ancient coral reef heaved to the ocean's surface. Handholds were plentiful, and Amon easily climbed the 10 meters or so to the top of the cliffs. He hauled himself over the top and stood to survey his surroundings. The coral island resembled the dune sea of a black desert, the ground underfoot gritty like broken glass or granulated basalt. He heard the soft whisper of the ocean's infinite spaces and limitless wonders. Amon half turned back towards the water, but his resolve held firm, and he resisted the call to swim forever in its depths. Instead, he pushed on, climbing steep ridges and unnaturally shaped contours. The ground crunched underfoot as he climbed towards what he hoped was the center of the island. Without the ocean's buoyancy, his body felt inordinately heavy, far worse than when his subtle body returned to flesh. His body glove hung from a physique wasted by the many years he had spent following the secret footsteps of his lost father. Never in his life had he felt so weak. Amon stumbled and sank to his knees. The breath rattled in his chest, as though filled with glassy fragments, and his eyes stung with abrasive dust blown from the ground. He heard the crunch of footsteps across the coral surface, and wearily lifted his head, squinting through eyes gummed with dust and stinging sweat. A tall man, swathed in a ragged cloak of dark feathers, was coming towards him with faltering strides, using a hecka staff fashioned from driftwood for support. His hair was matted grey, pulled back over wrinkled skin to a long scalp lock that reached to the ground behind him. Tied across the centre of his skull and obscuring his eyes was a filthy bandage, one side stained with ancient blood.
"Who approaches?"
asked the blind man.
"Ahriman, is that you?"
Amon shook his head, too horrified at what had become of the father he had so loved to form a coherent reply. He licked his lips.
"No,"
he replied at last.
"It is Amon."
"Amon?"
said the blind man.
"Oh, my son, of course. You came. You finally came."
"I crossed the world to find you,"
said Amon, his head sinking down over his chest and tears spilling down his cheeks as it dawned on him that his lonely quest was finally over. The blind man's hand reached down to touch his shoulder.
"My son," said Magnus the Red, "welcome to the orrery."
From darkness to light. Ahriman had read the near-death accounts of drowning victims, and in many such cases the survivors spoke of seeing a bright light in the instance before being hauled back to life. Some attributed these experiences to witnessing something divine, but Ahriman had long known that to be false. Such experiences were simply dissociative defense mechanisms that occurred in times of extreme danger, a means of distracting someone from the imminence of their own death. Yet as the dark water bore him onwards, he saw the brightest light in the world rushing towards him as though down a narrow tunnel. The feeling of weightlessness fell away in a heartbeat, and the cold of the water was replaced with a searing heat. Ahriman's vision blurred, greying out as he passed from utter darkness to flickering orange brightness in a heartbeat. Brutal vertigo slammed into him, and he fell to his knees, palms splayed before him. Ahriman ripped off his helmet and cast it aside, retching what little remained in his stomach. His transhuman physiology made him all but immune to such weakness, but his limbs trembled, his vision spun, and his gut clenched as though poisoned. He moaned and made a fist with his hands, gathering up black and greasy clumps of oil-soaked sand. The source of the intolerable heat was behind him, and he looked over his shoulder to see a desert burning from horizon to horizon. A great wall of orange flame licked the sky, and towering spires of carcinogenic smoke had turned day into the ancient's vision of a fiery underworld. Structures melted within the flames, silver steel silos and vats. Kilometer-high drilling derricks drooped like waxen effigies, and container hangars collapsed inwards as their walls bent and split. Blackened vehicles sat abandoned before the blazing refinery. Thousands of wheeled trucks, armoured personnel carriers, main battle tanks and gutted tankers. The smell of burning metal and flesh was overpowering. Ahriman covered his mouth with a gritty palm, breathing mouthfuls of ash that tasted like it had spewed from a crematorium. He staggered to his feet and grabbed his helmet before lurching away from the wreckage of the burning refinery. His eyes stung with acrid tears, and his throat was scorched raw with heat and smoke inhalation. He walked until he could walk no more, finally crashing down behind a gutted rhino lying in a blackened shell crater. Ahriman coughed up great wads of frothed black matter and raised a hand to shield his eyes from the heat and brightness of the city-sized conflagration. Other figures moved through the haze, but only when they lurched from the smoke could he tell they were fellow legionaries. Hathor Mart emerged first, looking drained by his experience. Sanact came next, the swordsman for once looking less than perfectly balanced. Tolbeck came last, and even the Pyrai adept was not untroubled by the flames. One by one, they sank to their haunches in the lee of the wrecked vehicle.
"Where are we?" managed Sanact.
"I do not know," replied Ahriman.
Tolbeck reached up and wiped a gauntleted hand across the blackened hull of the rhino. He smeared the soot, but enough cleared to reveal an icon painted onto its side, that of a great king casting what looked like serrated teeth from his outstretched hand.
"You recognize this?" he said.
Ahriman nodded.
"King Cadmus sowing the dragon's teeth."
"The icon of the Yasulti," said Hathor Mart.
"Throne. Does that mean..."
Ahriman pushed himself to his feet and climbed to the lip of the crater. Beyond its blasted lip, he saw an encamped army of global conquest. Tens of thousands of armoured vehicles, millions of soldiers, and an armada of hovering aircraft. All under eagle-struck banners of crossed lightning bolts.
"We are on Terra," he said.
Lemuel studied each of the statues as they climbed the processional stairs higher into the mountain. The faces were not unfamiliar to him. He had seen a great many of them upon marble plinths arranged around Oculum Square at the heart of Tisca.
"Do you know them?"
asked Widdowson.
"Once I did," said Lemuel,
unable to mask the bitterness welling within him.
"But your interrogator's psychic trawling and years of abuse in that orbital hellhole purged the memory of their names from my mind."
Widdowson shrugged, as if the matter were of no import, and anger touched Lemuel.
"My life and my suffering means nothing to you, does it?"
Widdowson paused, hearing the anger in Lemuel's voice.
"You lay down with Maleficarum," said the warrior. "You only remain alive because Yasu Nagasena, thinks you will be of use in helping us destroy the remnants of the Red Cyclops. I thought you understood that.
I thought...
You thought what? That you were forgiven? There is no forgiveness for consorting with evil. There is only penance.
So this, said Lemuel, holding up his arm and aiming the stump at Widdowson.
This is my penance. Fenris Yolda, no!
laughed Widdowson.
From what Biaki tells, this is just the beginning of your journey.
As if this were the funniest thing he'd heard, Widdowson slapped a palm on his thigh and kept climbing, shaking his head with mirth.
Come!
He shouted back.
You walk in my shadow or you die.
Lemuel trudged up the steps after him, letting the pain of his crooked legs fuel his anger towards his captors. He knew it was pointless. What good would anger do? But he sustained it nonetheless, imagining all manner of violence worked upon the wolf's head. He had reached 108 ways he would enjoy seeing Widdowson die before they reached the summit of the steps. Lemuel's leg moved automatically, seeking the next step and finding that there were no more. It wasn't the top of the mountain, not by a long way, but the air felt thin and the sun was perfectly framed over spires of rock too angular and too evenly spaced to be the result of any natural processes. The interior of the mountain's flank had been reshaped in the likeness of a grand arena, like the killing grounds built by ancient Romani kings to stage bloody games for the entertainment of the masses. At least 500 meters in diameter, tiered arrays of stone benches climbed from the sand to a dizzying height, enough to seat 10,000 souls. But only one awaited them. Lemuel's bowels turned to water, and his bladder cramped with the almost uncontrollable urge to empty itself.
No,
said Lemuel, as if denying it would somehow make it not so.
No!
Seated upon a great throne of gold opposite them, within the Emperor's raised pavilion, was the splintered soul shard of Magnus the Red, clad in armour of bronze, and with his glittering blade unsheathed across his thighs. Lemuel had never seen this aspect of the Crimson King, but it was clear this was the Primarch, arrayed for war. Magnus's red hair was bound by a golden circlet with a red gem at its centre, and the hatred that flowed into Lemuel from the Primarch's burning eye was so singular it drove him to his knees, weeping in terror. His own human hate was a petty thing by comparison. Lemuel hated the wolves for breaking his legs and locking him away in purgatory for 5 years. He hated them for being part of the reason the galaxy was aflame. But such grievances were insignificant when set against the raising of a world and the death of suns.
"Do you like your place of execution?" asked Magnus.
The four legionaries marched from the wrecked rhino towards the Imperial lines, gazing about themselves in wonderment. None of them had set foot on Terra in decades, nor had any truly expected to see it again. Even though the air was thick with petrochemicals and ash, every breath felt different.
"I can't believe it," said Hathor Mart. "I'd always assumed the stories of travellers cast through time by the great ocean were allegorical or metaphors for deeper truths. I never expected them to be real."
"I don't think any of us did," said Ahriman.
"Then why did we follow the word of a demon?"
demanded Tolbeck, the vast inferno burning behind them, inflaming his pyri passions.
"On a straw thin hope?"
"It was the only hope we had,"
pointed out Sanact.
"You would agree with him, wouldn't you?"
"Enough,"
snapped Ahriman, as he saw Sanact reach for his blades.
"Look, our arrival has not gone unnoticed."
A demi-squadron of cavalrymen was riding towards them on gleaming steeds with flaming red pennons.
"Didn't our legion take part in this fight?" said Hathor Mart.
"I believe we did, but whatever records there are of it were lost on Prospero," said Ahriman,
searching his memory for what little information had been recorded of the Boeotian campaigns.
"Then might we expect these men to be surprised to see four legionaries walking from the ruins of an enemy refinery?"
pointed out Sanact, as the five riders lowered gleaming steel-tipped lances.
"They will be," agreed Ahriman, with a note of real regret in his voice. "But we are space marines.
and in this time, the Legiones Astartes are all loyal to the Emperor.
The riders reined in their cybernetic steeds, and Ahriman saw they were green-jacketed hussars with plumed helms of an impractical-looking design that left their faces exposed. Their lances were lowered, but when they saw the nature of the warriors before them, they were swiftly raised. The lead rider spurred his steel horse forwards and socketed his lance in a holster, worked into the mount's flank.
"I am Captain Barado Bongiovanni," he said in thickly accented Gothic, with the slow cadence of the Terran-born. "We weren't expecting to see anyone walk out of that blaze this morning, let alone warriors of the legions."
Ahriman nodded and said,
"The fall of a Terran dynasty, even a rebel one, merits the attention of the 15th. "Indeed so, Lord," replied Bon Giovanni. "But some advance word would have been a courtesy."
Ahriman was impressed. The arrival of the Emperor's legionaries would intimidate most mortals, but Bon Giovanni was maintaining his composure. His riders spread out in a line, lances raised and their crimson gonfalon snapping in the rogue thermals billowing from the refinery.
"You are, of course, correct," replied Ahriman. "But matters are afoot that require immediate action, which does not always allow for professional courtesy between fellow warriors. My apologies to yourself and Commander Selud." "Your legion, my lord," said Bon Giovanni. "You don't need to apologize. But Commander Selud's not in charge anymore."
"Of course not," agreed Ahriman, as his recall of this moment in the Legion's history caught up with the conversation.
"He was removed at 0635, wasn't he?"
"He was,"
said Bon Giovanni.
"How did you know?"
"You recognize to which legion I belong."
"You are 15th, Lord, by your millennial markings?"
"Then that should answer your question."
Bon Giovanni nodded with a reckless grin and shifted in his saddle, as if debating whether to say anything in reply.
"Captain?"
asked Ahriman.
"Those matters you mentioned,"
asked Bon Giovanni, obviously keen to earn glory at the side of the Emperor's finest.
"Can we help?"
"As a matter of fact, you can," said Ahriman.
Promus walked carefully towards Magnus, feeling as though a host of unseen eyes were upon him. The rising bench seats were empty, but the sound of the wind blowing over them was like the soft murmur of myriad silent observers.
"You know this place, don't you?"
said Bjarke. Promus nodded. "He mocks us with what he has wrought. He knows I will recognize its significance."
"Then we mock him back,"
grinned Bjarke, turning and spitting on the ground, shifting his frost-bladed sword from hand to hand. Promus hadn't even noticed he'd drawn it.
"Hjoldr!"
cried the wolf towards Magnus, swinging his sword in muscle-loosening practice swings.
"This is a grand fighting pitch you've made, but I've seen better. On Fenris, the Farsk cut into the ice for theirs, but the bolt were more direct, yeah? Bone spikes around the edges, a few heads on spears, that sort of thing. Ah, but the Ostman, oh, the Ostman, even if their land thirst was slaked and there was no need to go on the murder make, they would reave and take many captives. They would pit tribe against tribe and make red snow underfoot, even when there was no snow lying."
Bjarke paused, grinning like a madman, as he turned in a slow circle and nodded slowly. The rune priest planted his sword in the ground before him.
"But it will do for us to slay you again."
Promus stood with Bjarke on his left as Magnus rose from his throne. The Primarch's single eye blazed with anger.
"Do you really think you can defeat me?"
he asked. Bjarke shrugged.
"Maybe, maybe not. Since when does that matter?"
"It matters," said Nagasena,
appearing at his other shoulder and drawing his borrowed blade.
"If Menkaura is to be believed, it matters a great deal."
Though no love had been lost between Promus and the swordsman, to see Nagasena without Shujiki was somehow unnatural. No matter that this sword was perfectly balanced and crafted by a master, it was not his. It did not bear the promise Nagasena had made upon it.
"The blind oracle," said Magnus. "Yes, let me see my son."
You were warned, continued Promus, ignoring the Primarch's request and unsheathing his thigh sword of blue steel and crystal. I was there. I stood with Targutai Yashugai and many of my brothers to speak for you. We did this unasked, because we believed it was the right thing to do. He stepped towards Magnus, and a surge of psychic energy along his blade set it aglow. Promus fought to control his anger, an anger that had, until this moment, smouldered like a banked fire, but which now threatened to grow into an inferno. He was dimly aware of the Ursarax spreading out to his left and the Vorax automata stalking to his right. He paid them no heed. All his fury, all his hurt, and all the aching sense of a brotherhood betrayed on that day pouring out of him in a torrent of anguish. "You broke faith with the Emperor, and you broke faith with your brothers," roared Promus. "We defended you, but you lied to us, to all of us. You have no right to feel anger towards us, none. You were warned. And for what did you betray us? A chance to gaze into the abyss and see what might stare back?"
"You have no idea what I saw," said Magnus.
Promus shook his head, taking another step towards Magnus. His allies followed suit, and he felt their unease. He shared it. Approaching a Primarch with hostile intent, even a splintered shade of one, felt like suicide. But Promus was past caring. He aimed his sword at the Crimson King's heart. "I remember the Emperor's command word for word. Woe betide he who ignores my warning or breaks faith with me. He shall be my enemy, and I will visit such destruction upon him and all his followers that, until the end of all things, he shall rue the day he turned from my light." Did you think that was an empty threat? Did you really think your lies would not be uncovered, that you could betray your father and he would not know of it?
The fire on Promus's sword grew brighter with every word, until it shone with the luminance of a sun.
"You broke faith with the Emperor," repeated Promus, his heart breaking anew and his voice cracking as he spoke words that had been bottled inside him for years. "So I ask you this. What else could you expect but Primarch Russ and his wolves being set upon you?"
Magnus dropped lightly to the sands and marched towards them. Promus steeled himself for the fight to come, marshalling his psychic defences and lifting his blazing sword to his shoulder. Magnus walked calmly into the heart of the arena like a champion gladiator, ready for the bout to secure his freedom. The Vorax and Ursarax extended their curving lines around Magnus to surround him. With the exception of Olgir Widdowson, who remained by Lemuel Gaumon's side, the Space Wolves stood with their leader. Only Sister Caesaria did not draw closer, ensuring her null did not impede his and Biarki's powers while keeping Menkaura's ability deadened. Magnus surveyed the forces arrayed against him and grinned.
"Tell me, Master Nagasena, how many men did you bring with you when you climbed the steps of the Preceptory to kill the Crusader host?"
"Around 300 Black Sentinels," said Nagasena. "And I never went there to kill them." "Don't say another word," snapped Promus.
300, said Magnus. "That would seem a woefully inadequate number for such a potentially dangerous mission."
Perhaps, but one of your own sons prevented it from becoming a massacre, said Nagasena. "A warrior named Athava."
Promus saw a change in the Crimson King's aura. A pained regret that on any other individual he might have attributed to guilt. It vanished almost as soon as he noticed it. Magnus looked left and right at the ring of steel and flesh encircling him. He lifted his golden kopesh and swung it in a dazzling figure of eight, his eye alight with anticipation.
"Do you think you have brought enough to kill me?" he asked.
"We shall see," said Nagasena.
Magnus grinned and cracked his neck.
"Indeed we shall."
Promus lowered his blade and looked back over his shoulder to where Credence Araxae and Vindicatrix awaited his word. He nodded and said,
"Fire!"
A floating sphere of warp flame illuminated the lee of an overhanging spur of coral upon Magnus's island. It required no fuel and cast a warming glow over Amon and his gene sire. They sat in silence, watching the dance of stars from a cliff high above the dark ocean. Within the water, it had seen the stars were static, but from here Amon now saw they moved in an intricate pattern that appeared random, but actually possessed an underlying motion as predictable as clockwork. He studied Magnus's face. He had not thought it possible, but his father had profoundly aged. The courage that had seen him do battle against Layman Russ was still there, as was the wisdom in his hidden gaze. But the lines on his face were deep canyons, and his skin had the texture of yellowed vellum. Amon struggled to know what to say. He and his father had always enjoyed a close rapport, but the man before him felt like a stranger. Had so much time passed for Magnus that he had forgotten their friendship. Yet simply being in the presence of Magnus was invigorating, and the weariness that had plagued Amon as he climbed from the water was diminishing with every passing moment. But such renewal came at a price, and with his returning strength came all his old hurts. The grinding agony pulsing from the shattered ruin of his spine, spliced with innumerable grafts bonded by Pavoni artifice, would always be with him.
"I'm sorry, my son," said Magnus at last.
"For what?"
"For the pain you suffer because of me," said Magnus, staring far out to sea. "And for leaving you in the great ocean as I did. That was not my intention. But I lost myself. I was distraught, and I had to begin the building of the orrery alone."
Anger touched Amon, an emotion he had never thought to feel towards his Primarch.
"Then why ask for my help?"
"I did."
"Yes. Atop the Obsidian Tower, you promised we would build the greatest library the galaxy had ever seen. You told me we would build it together."
Magnus shook his head with a rueful sigh.
"I was boastful back then," he said.
"Back then?"
asked Amon.
"How long have you been here?"
Magnus shrugged his raven-cloaked shoulders and sighed.
"Too long. How many years did you spend in search of me?"
"I do not know. A great many, I think,"
said Amon, hearing evasion in Magnus's answer.
"Time is hard to gauge on the planet of the sorcerers."
Magnus nodded, accepting that truth, and they lapsed into silence once more.
"So you found a place for the orrery," said Amon, looking out to the sea.
"I did,"
agreed Magnus, running a hand across his features, and Amon saw just how deep the weariness in his father's soul ran. Seeing him so bowed made Amon want to weep.
"The moment I left you, I was not myself," said Magnus, his blindfolded gaze never leaving the cold flames. "Much of me had been broken beyond repair, Amon. Too much has already been lost. In truth, I am not sure I can ever be the soul I once was. If I go back with you, I fear I will diminish with every breath."
Amon's anger fled in the face of Magnus's vulnerability. How little he and his brothers understood of their father's burdens, and how much they had taken his immortal presence and unbending strength for granted. Magnus reached a hand out of the fire, staring into its pellucid depths.
"When I came back to myself, I was so very, very far from you in time and space. I wanted to bring you to me, but I could not hear the song of the world ocean calling to me in my mind. And when I found this planet, the place where I would build the orrery, and saw the scale of what lay before me, I knew I could only do it alone."
"Why alone?"
pressed Amon.
"I could have helped."
"No. You would have been long dead by now."
Amon kept silent. Magnus's words spoke of a time span where even a functionally immortal legionary would certainly perish.
"And you spent all the time since then building the orrery?"
asked Amon.
"Filling its world ocean with memory?"
"Among other things," said Magnus with a grin. "Sometimes I would fly the great ocean to gain a better understanding of how the galaxy had moved on without me.
Once I even dared Lorgar's Ruinstorm and bore a creaking ship of Vulcan's lost sons through its tempests.
So what happens now? Magnus stood, and his raven cloak parted to reveal his armor, burnished bronze and boiled red leather.
We go back to what remains of our great legion. We attempt to finish what I have started here with the time I have left.
Amon stood and held out his hand.
We will finish it together.
We shall, said Magnus.